I'm here now.
Okay. I'm here now. I'm here now. I'm promised again. Don't find me.
Don't stop without.
Welcome to Podcast on Fire 114, episode entitled 92 Legendary La Rose Noire. Again, you get an idea what we're doing later in the show. But anyway, my name is Kenneth Wilson. I will be your host for this evening, and with me is sort of fresh from his fiery and German experience, i.e. Rammstein concert, Hong Kong Dave. And Tom KW, who didn't do anything akin to seeing Rammstein this week.
No. Good evening.
But just yeah, you're sort of the classy one that didn't experience fire and German industrial this week. So you're of the good evening kind, and David is.
We'll see Barry Manilow.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. And David will be like, Schnell, podcast now. Alrighto. Before we go into the network updates and our last movies watched and our feature review, let's do some contact information and some shout-outs. So, this is Podcast on Fire, the anchor show of the Podcast on Fire network. And our website is at podcastonfire.com. You can contact us through various means. First of all, email podcastonfire@googlemail.com. We are all on our message forum, podcastonfire.com/forum. As always, you have the members only archive there to extend your POF experience. We don't add to it right now because we occasionally do bonus episodes instead and post them on the website, exclusively on the website and not for the iTunes and Stitcher audience, for instance. Over on Facebook, we have our fan page located at facebook.com/POF network, but also our discussion group that you can find by searching Podcast on Fire Network, and that will pop up as well as the page. And we're also on Twitter, twitter.com/podcastonfire. My writing is done over at sogoodreviews.com, and currently I believe the review up is for the Taiwan movie The Country of Beauties, aka Island Warriors, but tomorrow will be the, because you're hearing this on a Saturday, tomorrow will be the review of what the fuck is it? Official Exterminator, Kill for Love, which is an IFD movie starring Mike Abbott and ninjas, combined with the Taiwan movie Kill for Love. IFD didn't even bother to sort of retitle it. It was already a pretty good title, and that movie Kill for Love stars Lu Xufang, which is my wife. That will be.
She doesn't know about it though.
Yeah, it's my wife, circa early 80s Taiwan. But you know, she's still incredibly gorgeous or whatever. She will be mine. Oh yes, she will be mine.
Nice.
All that is video reviewed at sleazykvideo.com, so you'll be seeing Official Exterminator Kill for Love over at sleazykvideo.com. And I'll be talking about it, of course, at twitter.com/sogoodreviews. And the Podcast on Fire Network is available on iTunes as well, so rate and subscribe to us over there. And we can be streamed via Stitcher as well, so you can download from Stitcher.com that application to your computer and add all the various Podcast on Fire Network shows individually. But that application is also available for various smartphones, including iPhone. And it's a mighty good application to stream the Podcast on Fire Network if you don't prefer iTunes. I actually don't like I don't like streaming from iTunes. I think it's a bit more unstable, at least here. Stitcher is a lot more stable from where I'm at. So, and tell us about what's been going on Hong Kong Gig Guide. No Rammstein gigs in Hong Kong in the near future?
No, man. The big show coming up is in a couple of weeks' time. It's the 100th numbered show by local promoters, Underground. They, encourage, original local music, and they've been doing shows for the best part of a decade now, so they're actually hitting their 100th show milestone. So
wow.
That's it's quite big news.
That's a mainstay of the scene, then.
Yeah, very much so, yeah.
Very cool. All right, Tom, your big announcement. What's been going on at vcinemashow.com?
I had a review posted.
Wow. Hey! Wow.
Yeah.
What was the review and how was it? Enter the Phoenix, okay.
Enter the Phoenix, yeah, went up just recently. So you can get there and read that one. I've got my contribution to the Korean Blogathon. I'm working on that at the moment, so that'll be up very soon. I'm just going to say that it's Korean.
Oh, aren't you a clever bot?
Yes,
I'm going to review a mainland movie because I'm rebellious Tom. Crazy Tom. All right,
Crazy FM.
Korean Blogathon will be actually be mentioned a little bit later in the network updates. But some shout-outs. First of all, to Shelf Life Clothings and Brian Kirby, and also sort of the intro outro extraordinaire Brian Kirby. He supplies the intro music you always hear on this show, the track called What's Your Style. And congratulations to Brian and his wife Laura, who became proud parents like a week ago, of a healthy baby boy called Desmond, a shelf life baby called Desmond. And so congrats, Brian, he's mighty happy. That's really inspiring to see, you know. And he's already introduced his cat Samo to Desmond, and it turned out very well. You know, it was not a video, online video gone wrong or anything like that. So, would be weird if he posted that too. Right, upload to Facebook. No. So congrats, Brian, and thank you for all your contributions to the Podcast on Fire Network, either as guest or just lending your musical talents and your jingle talents. He does the This Week in Sleaze intro as well, and that's Brian you hear doing the This Week in Sleaze intro. You're welcome to This Week in Sleaze with your hosts and all of that. So he's the newscaster voice, so to say. So good on you, Brian, and congratulations, Laura, as well. You're hearing this on a Saturday, and you know, during this very Saturday, our very own King Who, a.k.a. Jared, is getting married to his lovely bride, Wei Wang. So it's been a long time coming. And now finally their journey, you know, becomes complete and sort of is started as well. So congratulations, King Who, marrying Mrs. King Who, I guess. I don't know if he's going to get actually very far with that name change. If he's even attempted it, you know, where can we be called Mr. and Mrs. King Who? No! It's enough that you have our movies stored in our in the basement. Can't be called that. So, but regardless, congratulations, Jared. And it's one of the reasons why Jared hasn't been on This Week in Sleaze lately, because all the concentration has been in regards to the marriage and preparations, and also finding another place to live, finding a house or apartment. So, as I always say, that stuff in life goes first, and the Dopey Podcast isn't even on the list of priorities. So, he's hoping to get back on This Week in Sleaze very soon. But This Week in Sleaze is not a lost podcast on the Podcast on Fire Network, as I'll be talking about a little bit later. Today I actually found out about a new podcast out there, and I'm always delighted to find productive people out there, passionate people out there, genre fans that talk weekly on a podcast. It's always encouraging. So I found this podcast that probably everyone else have heard of, but I'm late to the party as usual. And it's called Silver and Gold. Ooh. Yes, and I found out about this by listening to Podcast Without Honor and Humanity, their episode 54, where they, among other things, reviewed Andrew Cam's Fatal Termination, you know, the movie where the little girl is held out of a speeding car. Yeah. Jacob had a guest on there called Dr. Zom. That's his podcast stage name, if you will. And, you know, he was a sort of a wonderful foul-mouthed co-host, guest on that particular episode. I liked his energy, so I got a chance today to sample a little bit of the podcast Silver and Gold, which, by the way, makes it maybe the second podcast that sort of incorporates Henry Silva as their sort of mascot, because the other one is The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema. Clearly, they have Henry Silva as in their on their blog, yeah, amidst the logo to The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema. There you have Henry Silva. So, and why not? You know, I have no particular relationship to Henry Silva other than seeing the movie Foxbat, which was directed by a Hong Kong director. But otherwise, I've not seen any Henry Silva movie. Great face, though. So I am all for that. So, but the episode I sampled, which was their episode 14, which features a review of Wong Jing's High Risk. I never got to a review. I'm going to continue listening to that tomorrow. But, you know, it's all good, fun banter. And that's infectious to listen to, really. Makes that, you know, steep running time, 2+ hours, just fly by. So well done already. I'm going to check out the rest of that. And we'll link to that, obviously. And also, if we're going to talk of Asian Connections within their podcast archive, which is around about 20+ episodes by now. Episode 7 features a review of the classic Tetsuo the Iron Man, which is the great black and white Japanese cyberpunk weird-ass movie, which I thoroughly enjoy. And I'm dying to rewatch it, actually. So all linked in the show post, and the website, if you want to go there right now, is silverandgold.com.
Yep, great podcast. Great couple of us.
Have you guys heard of it before?
Yeah, I've listened to their early episodes, and they're like very much a GGCMC-esque show, but they've got their own flavour, and they're funny and informative at the same time.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that one. I have to give it a listen.
Yeah. And a last shout-out, and a bit of a, not shout out, a bit of a sad and tragic news story I wanted to mention, because this week was reported that 20-year-old Chinese martial arts actress Bai Jing was unfortunately stabbed to death by her husband, Chao Chenghai, at their Beijing home, and her 44-year-old husband, and that then reportedly killed himself. And it's speculated right now, and there's a lot of speculation, we won't go into it, such that Chao killed his wife after his wife wanted to divorce him. But then there's a lot of stories and speculation about her wanting to divorce him because she didn't know about his previous marriage and the son that was part of that marriage, and there's stories about the fact that she blackmailed him and all of that. But, you know, whatever, you know, it's just a tragic thing to happen regardless. It's not supposed to end up like that. It's not really, you know, it's not really something that that is, I don't know if the word is fair, but, you know, it hits you. It's obviously a very, very sad and tragic end to several people, and it affects a lot of people, obviously. And Bai was in, amongst other things, she was in television dramas and films, including the 2010 action film, I think it's called I Love Wing Chun, or Kung Fu Wing Chun, which she co-stars alongside Cara Hoy, and she also appeared in Three Kingdoms Resurrection of the Dragon in 2008 alongside Andy Lau and Sammo Hung. So that was a talent in the making. I know Michelle Yeoh spoke highly of her. So, you know, that's unfortunate, quite unfortunate, and just chilling, a chilling story, you know.
Yeah, very sad.
But we'll be moving on, and this won't be the bummer podcast as such. So we'll be moving on to network updates. And I've had quite a busy week, actually. I always do, but the podcast recordings, I've been sort of going, the gear has been engaged to high, and it will continue to be throughout this week. We put up the latest What's Korean Cinema, Season 2, Episode 1, Castaway on the Moon. That featured myself, Paul Quinn of Hangul Celluloid, this time throughout the show and not a called in solo segment, and Rufus Duran from Sin Awesome was on as well, and that was really, really fun to like now and start a season that is about highlighting the rare, obscure, and untalked of Korean cinema that needs to be talked of more. This is a current movie, but will be focusing on old movies as well. But Castaway and the Moon, not easy to watch. I think the DVD is fairly rare, but I think it's on YouTube as well. So if you want to watch it, including you guys, if you haven't, I think it's on YouTube subtitle, and it's a wonderful movie. So I hope you don't need to watch the movie and then listen to the podcast. It's not, you know, that's not what I'm implying. It's just a wonderful movie. Have you in fact watched Castaway and the Moon, guys?
I haven't, no. I've not had much time off lately, but I got a few spare days coming up, so right.
Below 2 hours. It's actually a few minutes shy of 2 hours even, so that's nice. That's a treat in itself. But it's a great movie, and it stars the actor whose name I'm forgetting right now, who played the North Korean general in Welcome to Dongmakgol. He's completely different here. He goes for it in his... It's a Castaway movie, Robinson Crusoe type movie, so he goes for it in terms of that look. So he looks... Even before that happens, his Castaway situation, he still looks way different than in Welcome to Dongmakgol. So he's a bit of a chameleon, actually. But that's just me, so... but that was done. I also, this was yesterday, and also yesterday guested on the East Screen, West Screen 100th episode. So that was an honor being on again with Paul and Kevin. I've been on once before. But also Love HK Films, Ross Chen was on the episode. So I had a chance to speak to him for the first time, actually. So it was good fun. We didn't talk of any East Screen movie or West Screen movie. It was just a casual chat about their podcast history and our websites, and really free-for-all chat that went out live as well on their live stream. But I promise you guys, I behaved. So I think I only said shit like once, so, you know. I try to not be too sleazy at all times and too foul-mouthed at all times. It's hard, but I try. Hard to, you know, push Charlie Cho, so to say, back in me again. Possessed by the Tidy Whiteys, you know what I mean? Anyway. So, movies watched for the various network shows that we're planning have been in heavy rotation as well. Particularly the category for Easter, because this Sunday, tomorrow, when you're hearing this episode, I finally get to reboot This Week in Sleaze. And I thought of doing it as an experiment for at least one episode to do a solo chat on Robot Tricks and Escape from Brothel that we've been planning, you know, our double bill. But I actually asked someone to come on that hopefully could be sort of a presence on most of the episodes, and I asked V Cinemas and Varied Celluloids Josh to be on, because every chance Josh gets to, you know, I think he mentions rape every V Cinema episode, and obviously that makes him a prime candidate for This Week in Sleaze. You know, two rape men in the same room, kind of. Yeah, bitch. So we'll be doing an easy show first, you know, Robot Tricks and Escape from Brothel, you know, not much background, not much discussion, just do reviews of the movies. So it won't be a 3-hour shows like we've done in the past, because Dave, those movies we've reviewed in those type of shows that we've always discussed extensively, cast and background and all of that. But This Week in Sleaze double bill is a quickie and easy show to do, so to say. That will be sort of our end of March show, but the mid March show will be the previously recorded the director series 3 on Nam Night Choice for Seventh Curse. So that'll be fun, and that's a long one. That's a 2.5-hour show, but well worth it. You know, such good fun. Talking cast, essential cast, the big name cast like Chai Fat and Maggie Cheung. Despite this being sort of a, you know, a B movie on their resume, I still thought it was suitable to have the major discussion on Chai and Fat and Maggie Cheung connected to this movie. And it turned out really well. It was really good fun.
Damn fine time we had.
Yeah. So good on you guys. You know that was still in January. I mean, fairly early on in your sort of co-host duties and all of that. But, you know, you guys were on fire during that episode. You were inspired because the movie kind of does that to you as well.
Yeah.
going back again to What's Korean Cinema, next episode that we're planning sometime this spring, because Rufus and Paul are both busy men, and I am too, obviously. I'm not busy in life, I'm busy busy in my apartment planning all the episodes. No. So you be the judge if that's a life. But regardless, next on What's Korean Cinema is a double bill as well. We are going to do some Korean monster movies, Yeongari and Pulgasari. And they are being researched heavily, and we might do a more serious episode than you might expect, because in particular Pulgasari, that's a North Korean movie, and Kim Jong-il had something to do with that movie. And so it's going to be fun, but Paul and Rufus are so good at what they're doing, so I think that's going to be interesting, having them. I kind of am asking them to do the job because I'm the novice on the show, but I'm not sort of abusing and utilizing them, to make them do the work for me. I just think they can bring that to the table, so why not if they like to? I mean, they're passionate about it, and I would be too if I was in the same position to sort of provide research for a show that wanted to utilize my, so to say, expertise on whatever, So I think they're glad to do it, but we are going to try and schedule that sometime during the spring. Rufus, I think, is finishing off school, so that's obviously his. He's quite busy, and Paul always has stuff going on as well. Okay, and the work in progress is we're rounding off it, rounding off the network updates here. Work in progress is on sort of two other podcasts as well. The Next Japan on Fire on Mamoru Oshii, and. But that's probably being recorded sometime after the Korean Blogathon, because the Korean Blogathon that starts March 5th, which is 2 days from now. Is it March 5th? Yeah, that's it. Our official contribution will be that very episode that we put up a few days ago, What's Korean Cinema. So, but after the Korean Blogathon is done, I think Coffin John has a bit more free time to sit down with me again to... continue discussing Mamoru Oshii, and we'll be talking of Pat Labor and the Red Spectacles for that one. And from our side here, next week we are probably going to conclude the vampire season unless plans change. So again, as you heard before, main reviews in the final episode will be The Ultimate Vampire by Andrew Lau and Spook Encounters 2 by Ricky Lau, and with an additional review of Crazy Safari in the bonus episode. So that's going to be a whole lot of fun. Sometimes, we talk of movies like that you sell certain movies in a very, a cool way. We talked about Challenge of the Tiger last week. We talked about how Mike Leader sold that movie to us. Crazy Safari, I would like to sell as, to get people to watch it as, let's say Lam Ching Ying rides an ostrich. You need to watch it.
It's also my favorite Stephen Chow film.
Yeah, he provides voiceover narration, still unsubtitled though, even though it's on DVD, they still haven't fucking subtitled that. But regardless, it's a fun movie. I might as well ask you this, guys, any spontaneous thoughts on about the production rate for you personally, as co-hosts? You are now heavily involved in the research, is it still fun, essentially?
Yeah, I mean, I like having something to do on a regular basis, so it's not, it's not once in a blue moon, or it's not too much. It's, every week pretty much we do something, and that's good for me. I'm still very much enjoying it.
Yeah, I can hear it on when speaking to you guys and doing these kind of episodes that you're getting more and more comfortable. And I always think you were from the beginning, but it was infancy, and now you're growing sort of into it and getting used to what I'm expecting, because I don't always communicate very well, I think, what I'm expecting. But I think it becomes more clearer the more you work with me and the more you do research. So. Because it's hard sometimes to explain, because you work from within your bubble, and when it's time to sort of explain to someone, from outside of it, externally, it's not very easy sometimes. But I'm glad you always got sort of the intent, and I think it helped you being listeners as well. You've heard how shows have turned out, and now that you realize what kind of work it took to produce such shows. I think you kind of got it quite quickly, though.
Yeah, it's definitely a lot more involved than I thought it was as a listener. I thought, oh, you know, they just they've got a really kind of natural rapport, and it just kind of comes together. Mm-hmm. When you actually, you know, get involved and, you know, start to do, you know, some of the work, you realise, you know, there's a lot of work beforehand that goes on, you know, to make it sound that kind of easygoing and natural. You know, stuff
doesn't happen.
Yeah,
exactly. I need to sort of script what I want to say mainly on the show, and then obviously stuff comes to you. But because I'm not very sort of, I wouldn't say the word is a good improv man, but you know what I mean. I need structure. I need sort of I need to be prepared. I guess that's the easy.
Yes, easiest explanation. Same for me too. I think that's the best. It's the best way. It's the way forward for me. You know.
Right. What about you, Tom? What's your thought now? Because you are a few months older by now. I mean, I think we started in late December, possibly a bit earlier. Yeah, yeah, it was December, I think. In December. So, I mean, it's almost four months or so. I don't know.
I think so, mate. Yeah.
You're fired.
If
you're not gonna talk, then fuck. Yeah.
I've given up my job, my home, my girlfriend. I'm living in the streets in a cardboard box with a laptop attached to next door's electric. Ken, this is what I'm
That's
doing
dedication.
For you. This dedication. It's raining right now. Just imagine that, Ken. That's what I'm doing right now for you. Dedication. And you're going to fire me? You're going to fire me? Look at that. Look at that, Ken. What are you going to say to
that? I'm the Hitler of the network. Of course I'm going to fire you. You know, Tom is giving, getting whoever created This Is England new ideas, you know. We might do that instead, you know, the podcaster in a box. All good fun. Yeah, but you know, it's easy to get a sense of that you are flowing, you know, easily into the work. You know, getting understanding what work it takes as well, Tom. You know, it shows in the final results that you're certainly comfortable and willing to develop, just like I am. You know, 100 episodes in, if I didn't develop, if I didn't have a desire to develop, then I would be sort of scared and.
In all seriousness, it's been great, mate. Yeah, it's been great. In all seriousness, really enjoying it. Really enjoying getting into it. And I think because we've kind of found our flow and we're doing it kind of once a week, without any breaks, we're really kind of, you know, there's not any stop and start to it. We're really kind of flowing. So, yeah, I'm enjoying it, mate. Really, really am.
Right on. Last week you were a bit of a bad boy though, because you didn't watch any movies.
Mate.
So, bad boy. But this week, I gather that you watched a flick or two, Tom. So, last movie's watched. So floor is yours.
The film I want to talk about this week, gentlemen, is Knock Off from 1998, starring Jean-Claude Van Damme, directed by Choi Hawk. This is my first viewing of this film. I heard a lot about it. I wanted to go see. I'd seen Double Team, which is not particularly impressive. So I thought I'd dive straight into this one, and it definitely falls into the "it's so terrible / bizarre, it's actually amazing" category.
Yeah, more so than Double Team for me personally.
Well, yeah, definitely. I mean, if you want to see a film where Rob Schneider whips JCVD in his own words on his big beautiful ass with an eel.
Yes.
And in return, Jean-Claude is making horse noises all the while, bombing it through a Hong Kong street, towing Schneider in a rickshaw. You may want to check this one out, because, it's crazy. It's just, Choi Hawk is really just going for it in this. He's kind of putting everything on screen. I think everything that popped up to his mind, every single, like, camera angle that he
Within the fucking shoe that the action breaks, you know, the camera should be in there, and he did it.
Close-ups of like the individual strands of the trainer that Jean-Claude's wearing snapping, and dozens of shots of foam wires and electronic innards, and I mean, loads of shots down gun barrels and speed up, slow down, freeze frames. It's like Tony Scott took a dump on a late 90s Jaffa Jam film. After ingesting Chungking Express, after a heavy meal of Chungking Express, it's crazy. It's got that same vibe as that late 90s Jackie Chan stuff, but just turn to 11. It's just got the poor acting, the kind of the cartoonish characters, but it just somehow it pulls it out of the bag. It's crazy. There's some good action in it though. There's actually a scene where a truck goes through an upstairs platform of a restaurant, and a stuntman slams onto the top of the truck from the platform and is carried through some nice high jumps and stuff like that. And there's a nice fight on top of it, and yeah, there's some nice like car action as well. That stuff's well directed, and funny enough, Sammo Hung did the second unit directing, and apparently about three quarters of the action scenes were trimmed out of the final print. There's actually more of the fight scenes in the making of on the DVD from some of the fight scenes, because I don't know why, or whether it was down to pace or what, but the action serviceable in it. I would have liked to see a bit more, to be honest. It's actually, Jean-Claude actually looks good in it, which is down, I think, in his films, personally, for me, 50-50 chance of whether he's going to look good or not, I think, depending on the director.
Yeah.
I think he's got the talent there. It's just, how he shot. He shot well here, and even though Double Team is a bit of a shitty movie as well, he shot well in that as well. So I think Choi Hawks, he makes good use of his stars that he's got there. And it's fun. It may possibly be one of the best kind of bad action movies ever, and it's certainly one of Van Damme's most entertaining films.
I mean, it's never boring, really. Double Team could be argued. It's fun to speak of Double Team, but it's not really the most well-paced movie.
No.
Knockoff is just, sort of it's a ride. It's a good little ride. I enjoy it, and my simple review is great fun, and the Hong Kong flavor is always it's fun because you have a lot of recognizable faces. Was Michael in this? Michael Wong,
he's the kind of he seems like he's having fun in it. He kind of plays like the hard-boiled cop with scars on his face, and he hasn't got like a major role throughout. He pops up here and there, but then the last half an hour he kind of comes into his own. He's got some nice stunts. I think he does a zip wire from like a ship to just outside the ship, which is really cool. He did it himself, which is on the making of, and he talks about it. And his English is really good in this. Which sometimes is a bit of a scare with some kind of the Hong Kong accents, whether they're going to translate well into an English film. But Michael does fine. He's good. Was he born in America and grew up in Hong Kong?
Yeah, he's American Chinese. Yeah. So I mean, it's rather that when he mixes, the reason he mixes Cantonese and English is because he apparently never really became fully comfortable in Cantonese such. But that's all part of the Michael magic by now,
Yeah. Saxophone and all.
Yes, sir.
But yeah, the plot's a bit out there. I mean, there's so many double crosses in this film. There's more double crosses than a priest's mirror. it's kind of hard to understand, but it's so kind of fun. The plot's forgettable. It's not really needed. It's just fun, really fun. I don't think there's a boring, as long as you can believe that Jean-Claude Van Damme may be a fashion designer in Hong Kong. I think you can get on with this film. It's a recommendation from me. Easy, even if you don't like Jean-Claude, I think it's a recommendation. Just the fun of it. It's just a really fun film.
Yeah, and the Hong Kong connection certainly helps it
for
me. And I saw it like a few years ago, and it still survived pretty well. I mean, I think I was more receptive to it compared to when I saw it, maybe when it was 2 years old or one year old at the time. I'm more receptive to it now, and something I really should own, but you can probably pick it up very cheaply by now, and it's always been available too, because it's distributed worldwide by some big company. If it's Colombia, I don't know, but it's an available movie. So alrighty, anything else?
Nope, that's it, mate. That was enough for 1 week.
Yeah. Well, two movies, including the one we're going to talk of after the breaks.
Oh, I didn't watch that one.
Oh, okay. You know, wing it then. Yeah, 92 Legendary La Rose Noir. It was made in 1992. It has roses and noir.
The one with the Ekin Cheg, isn't it?
I liked it. can. okay, we're not there yet. All right, David, what did you watch since last we spoke?
Yeah, my last movie watched is Philip Chan's 1986 film Chocolate Inspector. Michael and Ricky Hoy, Anita Moy, and Sibel Hu. The idea is funny enough, decent amounts of comedy to get out of it. It's a beauty pageant entrant as a cop, Michael and Ricky Hoy are their usual good value, but the big issue with it really is the direction. It's just too heavy-handed for the material. It's got more than a few fun moments, but ultimately the quite sturdy direction kills the film long before the final credits, really. So, which is kind of disappointing because there are some good times there, but it's just it's not the right touch, directorial kind of touch for a comedy, really. It's just a bit too, just too heavy-handed, really.
Who directed that one, David?
Philip Chan. Usually pops up. He was in the,
He's in Hard Boiled. Order!
Yeah.
That's Philip.
He made a number of films, about a dozen or so, as a director, but... Nothing that was really that huge, I don't think.
Well, one of his hidden gems is actually a movie called Nightcaller with Pauline Wong, which is a murder mystery thriller that definitely echoes Dario Argento, but in a very confident and skilled way. So if you're going to seek out any Philip Chan movie, and good luck, that one is rare, seek out Nightcaller. Really solid stuff, and not a Hong Kong giallo that is made into a comedy as well. It's pretty straight faced, and he's in it as well, and Pauline Wong and Pata, I believe, in a small role. So did you even pick up on the fact, because I think, David, if my memory is not incorrectly, I've not seen Chocolate Inspector, but I've heard of it. I think this was shot in Sing Sound. That wasn't something you picked up on.
I don't know. I'm not sure on that one. I don't know. I'd have to go back and have another.
Because that always adds, a little bit of something to a movie to hear, comedic performance like Michael Hoy, Ricky Hoy, and Anita Moy, and all of that. So,
it definitely seemed like it was them doing their. Doing their dialogues.
Yeah, I'm looking at the John Charles review on Hong Kong Digital, and yeah, it was Sing Sound, which was rare in 1986. Became a bit more, but not hugely so frequent in the 90s. So that helps. But Hoy brothers, the complete trio, a dead cert, so to say, past their sort of prime 70s and early 80s. But then again, when they made a Chicken and Duck Talk, like a year or two later for Clifton Co., that's a really, really good movie. Mainly it's for Michael and Ricky, and Sam Hoy appears in a brief cameo. So per definition, it's a Hoy Brothers movie.
Yeah.
But I'm still keen to look at that eventually. No hurry, though. And... I don't think I've ever seen Anita Moy from in a Sing Sound movie apart from her very later works. So so that's enough motivation for me. Alrighty. Anything else you want to mention?
No, that's it.
Alrighty. And I'll run through three movies I watched, but really quickly, though. So I finally got into reviewing mode again, doing the main reviews on my site, sogoodreviews.com. It's been a few weeks because... I've been busy basically with the podcast, but I have so much in the pipeline since before, so it's not like the work is suffering. But I got back into my reviewing habits, which felt really good. So I watched Be Careful, Sweetheart, which from 1984, which is actually a swordplay movie, a wuxia from Taiwan, despite the title. And it's from the director of The Country of Beauties, aka Island Warriors, that I reviewed on my site. This is a director called Ulysses Au. And it was kind of confusing. I dig it. It's actually very good. Some connect this movie and the it stars Adam Cheng and Bridget Lin, and some connect this movie and another Adam Cheng and Bridget Lin movie, another wuxia called Night Orchid, which is a terrific, creative, gory, atmospheric genre movie. But its only connection is through genre and casting only. You know, Be Careful, Sweetheart is a bit more down to earth. You know, it's grand. It has, you know, great wire work and swordplay and all of that. But it's also its advantage is two things: that it's told clearly. These wuxias, especially if you watch Shaw Brothers, you know, when the twists start to happen, you know, you're absolutely, I am anyway, I'm usually quite lost. You know, it's beyond my comprehension to follow all the twists in movies like Killer Clans and what have you. But this one is clearly told, but not dumbed down, though. But it's also quite a human story too. Actually, it has some valid human drama, and actually makes it very, very good. Co-stars Derek Yee as well, which looks fucking fantastic. You know, he was a really cool presence in Imperial movies, and under the action direction of Fung Hak-on, who he looks really good. Him and Adam Cheng look fantastic. Not doubled and featured in a lot of cool exchanges. You know, they look honed. You know, it looks like they have basic training for movies anyway, after a few years of doing it. And Bridget Lin as well. You know, she's her action is sort of made to work because it has emotional context. So she's often part of the action drama beats, which is unusual that they connect action to the drama so well. So if you can find Be Careful, Sweetheart, it's on Taiwan DVD, but I watched a fan-subbed version of it, so it's out there on the internet. And Night Orchid as well, I recommend. That's fantastic. Not Nation, but I want to mention it anyway. A late-night Saturday viewing of the French New Wave horror splatter flick High Tension, a.k.a. Switchblade Romance. That never fails to amaze. I love the French New Wave horror of the last few years, you know. High Tension, Martyrs, or however you pronounce it, Inside, Frontiers, and just great, great stuff. And
nice.
Can't get enough of real splatter, you know, not CGI. You know, this is done for real for once. You know, the French realized that. And I've always been curious, these like really over the top violent movies from France during the last few years, it seems like the censors aren't that hard on them in France. They let go of violence quite, you know, quite easy. Because if you look at Inside, which is extremely bloody, man. but I'm glad that they don't interfere. So
I did like Frontiers. That was I think that's probably the only one I've seen of that kind of new wave you were talking about, Ken. Uh-huh. How would you rank that up against the film you mentioned, the High Tension?
I think High Tension is definitely better. The problem with Frontiers and a few other movies is that they try to have a sort of political backdrop.
It's set against a political election or something like that. No, they
I think it was mainly the riots, you know, the Paris riots a few years ago. And that wasn't really needed because it's genre. It's a genre movie. It could be connected to Texas Chainsaw Massacre in a way, but you know, it's not really needed. Maybe they need to do it because that's what the censors require. You know, to have some social context. Who the fuck knows? But High Tension is just really simple movie.
What's the French movie? Is the opening of it, it's based around like a young girl that's been kidnapped or something?
No, not really. It's just not that one. It's just these two girls who go to one of the girls' parents' house to study, and then during the night a killer arrives. So it's really simple stuff.
I think Martyrs might be the one you're on about, Dave.
That's
she goes up against the people who like kidnaps and torment her as a child.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. No. Couldn't sit through that one.
It's a tough one. I like Martis up to a certain point. I think it became really pretentious, to be honest. When the twist happened. But anyway, that's the French New Wave Horror Podcast. Coming soon to the French
Justify Network. Podcast. Damn it.
Righto. And finally, yesterday, I have a lot of movies on my portable hard drives through connections and trading and all of that. Not the Sea Eagle. These are better quality and more cheaper portable hard drives than the Sea Eagle. So fuck that. Fuck Sea Eagle. Anyway, that means that I can pick randomly, you know. So I'm just looking through the hard drives. Ooh, Monkey Business. What's that about? That's a 1982 comedy by Alfred Chung starring Kennedy and Anthony Chen. I'll give that a go. And it's interesting at times because it's sort of an admirable mix of broad goofy and dark goofy, sometimes just plain dark. It's a murder mystery sort of set mainly on a ferry. So Kenny B and Anthony Chan are sort of the comedic duo, and then they have to deal with a murderer on the boat. But it doesn't really work overall, though. It's interesting and admirable, but them as a comedic duo is rather weak, to be honest. So. But it's an interesting mix. From that time, 1982, during the New Wave, it seemed like it was, you know, movies were edgier during that time, during the Hong Kong New Wave.
You're such a vain bastard watching films you're in.
Pardon me?
You're such a vain bastard watching films you're in. It's outrageous.
That's me, in a nutshell.
Joke's never going to die, Ken.
No. It's sort of only mildly funny so far because I you know, I didn't really pick up on it once you brought it out. So we need to hone that joke a bit more, you know. Or we solve it in editing. You know what I mean?
I'll work on it, bud. Yeah.
But anyway, that was my last movies watched, and obviously I watched our feature movie for this week that we're gonna review. But more on 92 legendary La Rose Noir from 1992. Co-blimey, 1992. who knew? That's coming up after a break. Welcome back, and this week, as we promised, we three are going to review 1992 legendary La Rose Noir, as picked by Hong Kong Dave. So I'll let Hong Kong Dave speak of the movie and what he thinks of it in a nutshell before we go into the more deeper discussion, so to say. So take it away, David.
Thank you, mate. 1992 legendary La Rose Noir had a close on 6-month cinema run, which is...
6 months?
Six months.
Fucking hell.
Crazy. Wow. Which is, you know, rare in those days and, you know, is unheard of today. Stars Tony Leung Kar-fai, Theresa Moh, who can be considered, I think, pretty second only to Sandra Ng in the sort of queen of comedy stakes.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Maggie Hsu and Petrina Fung. Tony Leung won Best Actor. And Petrina Fung won Best Supporting Actress at the 93 Hong Kong Film Awards for their performances in this film. What's the plot? Unsuccessful writer involves herself, a friend and a cop with treacherous gangsters and the semi-retired, reclusive Caped Crusaders of a previous generation. It's chock full of references to 60s Cantonese cinema, but for me at least, I don't feel it requires any deep knowledge of that era, as it's funny in its own right. It's a complete joy to watch for me, and is easily my top 5 Jeff Lau films to date.
Right on. So that was sort of the quick opinion of yours, David. Mm-hmm. So what's the quick opinion of yours, Tom?
disappointed with what David said. I felt a lot of backstory, inspiration, etc. kind of went over my head, but I enjoyed the film in its own merits, in its own terms.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I went into it that way too, that I'm probably not going to get one iota of what goes on. And really, sometimes you need to test the waters with certain movies to see if you actually catch anything when you're not really part of the local audience in that regard. And I think the first half is really splendid, and it sort of peters out in the second half, but I still had fun overall, so I can't really critique the movie as such. I don't know how you guys feel about that very fact that going into a movie blind, that you sort of know, relies on, so to say, beforehand knowledge. I mean, this is one case where you, David, as you said, you don't feel like you need to, but you know, how do you feel in general? Is that a sort of fear for you, try and review it fairly in that regard? Or I don't know if there's any examples, more examples still, so maybe it's a dumb question, but how do you feel, David?
Well, when I first saw the film, was, you know, when it got its DVD release, which is, you know, 8 years ago now, I didn't know much else, you know, much about, you know, older eras of cinema, you know, didn't know a whole load, you know, in detail of the 70s, certainly not any further back than that. But I just kind of took it when I first saw it as, you know, it had kind of like a retro kind of feel to it, and I just kind of went with it on that basis, and just, you know, kind of let it kind of unfold, and you know, just kind of took it on, you know, on that kind of level.
Yeah, certainly a movie where that sort of train of thought, that going into it blind without any knowledge of what it references, that worked for you. This movie works for you in that regard. Mm. I mean, there's like a movie later in the 90s that just thought of it called. There's many movies in the 90s called Those Were the Days, but there's a particular one starring Francis M and Dia Wong, where Dia Wong plays this Wong Kar-wai as director who travels back in time and meets Patrick Che. Francis M plays Patrick Che, who's in Shaolin Soccer, by the way. He's the bad guy in Shaolin Soccer. You know, that relied on that also sort of channeled Black Rose like this movie does, but that was still fun to watch because the energy was there, and I think that's a key to this movie, that there's a lot of fun and wacky energy on display, even if it flies over your head. You know, it's certainly never boring, and and it's not too much either. It's not like it drains you, that everybody's trying to please you desperately.
Yeah, I mean, one of the sort of helpful things that they do, you see it at a few points in the film, you see the characters where they're watching TV and they're watching like an old movie or an old TV show. So you kind of get that it's suggested within the film that, you know, this is kind of, you know, it's kind of what they're going for. They're going for that sort of that older kind of style, you know, of performance and that, you know, because I've at least sort of two or three times, you know, you see a character and, you know, they're watching an old movie or something like that. So it's kind of, you know, they kind of work that into the film. They work that sort of, you know, suggestion in there that, you know, it's kind of what they're going for, you know.
I'd agree. Yeah, I think I love the hand-drawn like opening title cards, kind of sets you up for what you're in for with the film. Kind of very traditional and kind of soft focus. Kind of, you know, I think even if I, you know, don't get a lot of the references, I think just the feel of the film feels quite classic. It's shot very well. I mean, it looks really nice.
And thankfully, a remastered now. What we watched was the Meyer remastered DVD of the film, and they actually did clear out the print pretty nicely, actually. I mean, and that's not a given for a 1992 movie. A 1992 movie could look absolutely horrendous because of the storage conditions and all of that.
But
I do agree. I mean, I like the feeling of that it channels old-timey cinema. I think that's Jeff Lau's skill of striking, you know, a balance of silly humor and referencing, especially during this first half. And, you know, speaking of some specific examples, you know, I have no idea if I've even seen the actor that Tony Leung is sort of channeling with his performance, because I think it's an actor rather an actor, and maybe a bit of his known character on screen. But I like that, you know, because Tony is handsome. He's absolutely handsome, and he's suave and all of that. And but I love when he breaks his cool by having the inner dialogue about dropping the keys and hoping no one saw him.
which I think
is Jeff Lau's perfect balance between silly humor and referencing. I actually like that, because there you have the example of, I don't necessarily get what they're referencing. I know they are referencing something, but that was fucking funny. So, and even, you know, when, you know, in later scenes where he enters the apartment and watches Maggie Sue's script, and then Maggie Sue comes into the apartment and he uglies himself up by sellotaping the fuck out of his face, you know, to not look like himself no more. And that's why I love the first half so much, because Jeff Lau gives us, you know, all audiences a little bit something. All, for me, I was the audience that wanted to laugh my ass off, and I definitely did a lot with during the first half watching Tony Suave character be very silly, and Jeff Lau at one time, and I'm going to ask you something later, David, for me at one time just was the king of energy, comedic energy, and fast paced movies. You know, Haunted Cop Shop, one and two are perfect examples of this, where it's just, it's funny and crazy and boom, 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 energy. Mortuary Blues is a fine example as well. And, you know, I enjoy when this energy is there. I can't really explain it well. You just know when it's done well. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, even, you know, silly humor like when Theresa Moe's hair is in a mess after running to Maggie Sue's apartment in the middle of the night where it's on its side. I just love that stuff, because she opens the door and then you see Theresa Moe like that. I am absolutely weak for that stuff. But it's not easy. It's not easy to do. That requires performer energy, timing, and primarily a director steering that boat. It's not like Jeff Lau just sits with the fucking horse race guide, you know, for the evening, and yells action. You know what I mean? So, you know, that's why I admire Jeff Lau of this time, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, that is, you know, kind of blueprint, if there can be said to be one, is to me, kind of comedy, kind of through, like, accumulation. It's not sort of lots of quotable lines or, you know, crazy sort of pratfalls and stuff like that. It's like a situation on situation, performance on performance, and it kind of, you get a rhythm and a momentum, and it's sort of, you know, and it's sort of the comedy kind of derives from that, it, you know, from the performances and from the situations, and it gets a speed going, gets a sort of a pace and a rhythm, and that's kind of where it sort of generates the humor for me.
I think a perfect example is when Theresa Moe's she's dressed up as the old man.
Oh fuck, that was scary. That was so scary.
I love it when it's just that, as you said, Dave, it's just the momentum. I love it when Tony Leung takes to the toilet, and it's a classic, like, oh no scene, and she finds a way out of it. It's greeted with a so many bubbles remark from Tony, and then we have the almost like surreal scene of him like singing to her like a baby, and then it goes on to them two throwing up, and it's just like it's crazy, like it's just momentum and kind of energy upon energy upon energy, and it's just, you can't help but go along with what the film's throwing out at you, you know, for the first hour at least.
That scene in the toilet, I gotta elaborate a little bit more on that, because, you know, you Theresa, you know, as the public thinks she's Black Rose now, and she's recognized everywhere. So, for some reason, she knows how to, you know, dress up like an old man and get makeup done like an old man, you know, very convincingly. It's still terrifying. It looks absolutely terrifying. But, you know, when you get to that point where she plays an old man who needs help going to the toilet, and Tony insists on helping, and then, as you said, she pours a detergent down the toilet, and and she flushes the toilet, and that's fine. And then Tony looks over. Ooh, it's bubbly. Yeah, it's just, oh, that's so brilliant. That's so brilliant. And
it's almost throwaway, isn't it? When I saw that, like, that kind of image on, because that's the image that's on the DVD cover, her dressed up as the old man, I thought it'd be like kind of a big part of the film, but it's a throwaway scene. It's like 5 minutes. Like, I can't believe they went to that length to kind of get her dressed up in the full garb and had this complete, like, identity change. And it's for a small throwaway scene in the middle of the film. It's crazy.
I think she's really the star of the film for me. I missed Teresa during the second half, to be honest. And one of my favorite bits of humor and the way they sort of constructed is there's, well, two examples really. When they are cleaning up traces of themselves after witnessing the gangsters exchanging their stuff, you know, they clean up fingerprints, and then they cut to Teresa Moe washing the car, and then she realized, wait a minute, I don't need to wash the car, I was never out here, you know.
She's brushing her own teeth as well.
and sort of a final example I want to quote for Teresa is during the latest scene, they just speak of something that has happened off screen where she talks to herself, I can't believe I sank to the level of robbing congee from someone.
Oh, yeah. The little boy.
Yeah, exactly. And
that seems great, yeah.
And it's something that she essentially talks about, don't you know, I can't believe I did that. And so, and one of my final notes is actually that because there's not a whole lot of stuff that I can speak of in the second half. I kind of got lost, so I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are. But the clue for this movie, key for this movie, is that it has this free-for-all atmosphere and plotting where little needs to make sense, because it's a rule-breaking movie that is only in it for the fun and wacky atmosphere to throw stuff at you, and that's absolutely fine in the case of this movie, despite me being more lost than in the movie during the second half. But not all movies can argue that they are allowed to do that. You know what I mean? But I'm curious to hear what you thought of the second half, because for when Petrina Fung and Wong Wan-si's character are at the forefront, I was a bit more confused about the wackiness on display here. But I don't know, what did you think of there when they took over the movie, David?
I kind of like that bit. I mean, that part. I mean, the second half of the film is definitely it's kind of looser. Not that the first half is necessarily heavily sort of structured, but it's really inspired, and I think, you know, keeping that going, that kind of level for a whole movie was going to be always going to be kind of hard, but that gave it a real shot. It's just, you know, it does kind of, you know, drop off slightly, you know. But,
All of a sudden, your Tony's character is just gone from this suave character to being really a more panicky and crying character. All of a sudden, you know, he's stuck in a predicament, and I'm not always sure what predicament. But having said that, there's loads of funny stuff here, like whenever the bell is rung, Wong Wan-si is forced to practice kung fu. Bo Bo is absolutely insane. She has memory loss of some kind. So she thinks she's a kid. She thinks she's Black Rose at one point. She thinks she's, I think, like the girlfriend of Wong Fei Hung or some shit like that. I was actually confused. But I don't mind it at all, because I think Jeff Lau never bores with this. And you kind of need to do what you do with action movies sometimes. Just enjoy what's there and don't think too much about it. And it works, kind of, but the first half was still superior to me, because I was I got more out of it, more concrete stuff, if more story stuff, if you can argue there's even a story here.
Yeah, the Wong Wan-si playing the sort of very kind of masculine sort of character.
She's the fucking mother of Fung Bo Bo. What the hell is going on there?
I didn't quite get what that was. Obviously, I mean, it's a big part of, like, you know, Chinese opera. You know, women playing male characters and vice versa. You know, there's a bit of that in, you know, that kind of same kind of thing in Prodigal Son. You know, with Lam Ching Ying playing Chinese opera. You know, characters is a woman, and there's that sort of mistaken identity thing, and in Feng Se-yuk as well. You've got, God, I can't think of her name there. I played his mum.
Josephine Shaw.
Yeah. Fong, she dresses up as a man, and there's this sort of the storyline with the sort of, the mother of the sort of, prospective sort of, daughter-in-law.
I remember that now, yeah.
And then, of course, the whole basis of Mulan as well, the sort of Chinese, tale. So, there's a long history of that in Chinese opera and then cinema and sort of, in sort of European sort of, theatre as well, and, English sort of pantomime as well. It's a big, a long-running thing. It's been done for sort of, forever, really. But, that was, I didn't quite get what that bit was. It's obviously, she obviously bared some kind of resemblance to either sort of, I think probably like a character or an actor.
I mean, if anything, it's the part of the movie that I think references most heavily on stuff that locals would know of. It's not the mix of the kind of nonsense humor that Stephen Chow did well. I think the second half is just steeped in, I think, full-on references. It seemed like, anyway, there's some musical numbers. And that scene at the banquet where Tony Leung is... there's some stuff on the TV he doesn't want the people at the banquet to see. Someone actually ingests stupid powder, the delivery boy. There's a bit of a charade there. And I was sort of scratching my head. But it's still a credit to Jeff Lau that he sort of, I don't know how to really describe it. Stuff moves and is colorful, loud, and noticeable, and I don't know why it sort of amuses me, but it does. You know what I mean? It's a very basic, primal level that this movie entertains me on, despite being able to critique it. Not really critique it, but not being able to appreciate it as much. It's got stuff moves and sounds and there's movement, and I kind of like that.
it's the bit where the... sort of the banquet bit where the guy is trying to tell them that that Tony Leung's is a cop and that, and he's trying to do the trying to do the sort of charades bit and all that.
But every performer is there, Jeff Lau makes sure that they are on at all times, without being too abroad though.
One of the things I really like is the musical sequences where they're kind of singing, and obviously enough, it'd been a musical sequence. But there's the part where Tony Leung has got concrete in his hair.
Yes.
And they start singing this song, and then every time the sort of camera pans back to him, he's got a different hairstyle. One minute he's doing like a sort of a Jedward, kind of straight up in the air, and then the next time he's got it going out at sort of right angles from his head. It's just I love that bit. That's really good fun.
Yeah. What about you, Tom? Were you also a bit lesser in love with second half, but did you still enjoy being there for it, sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I felt it was exactly as you said. It's like a film of two halves, and I think the first half's like a fun, pretty light, kind of funny drama, and then it's sort of a black comedy, almost in the second half with the two characters sort of imprisoned against their will and these false identities. And I just found Petrina Fung just acting like a child slightly irritating, and I know it built up the relationship between Butterfly and Keith, and Keith and the roses, but I think the film moves so quick for the first hour, I felt a slight slowdown at that point because it was kind of the same location. Oh, yeah. It was these events kind of acting themselves out. Well, the first half, it just goes from scene to scene, location to location. It's really fast. And, the musical numbers are fine. I wish they were more evenly spread out rather than mushed all together in that kind of collection of scenes at the house. I kind of preferred it if they were a bit more, more spread out. I definitely enjoyed the second half. I didn't, shoot it off the second half sucks, or anything like that. It was definitely kind of a come down from the first half, but I still enjoyed it. But I got exactly the same feeling you did. I knew something was happening that I didn't quite grasp, so I just kind of sat along, enjoyed it for what it was, rather than kind of moan about it, because I knew what was happening. I knew it was obviously referencing something, or there's a lot of references being made. So it's the same, obviously, sometimes when you're watching Stephen Chow films, you kind of shut off for a second because you don't quite understand the reference.
And speaking of Stephen Chow and his co-star, Mantat, there's a scene here where Petrina Fong and Wong Wan Si, one of the first scenes, are talking about themselves in a photograph. You know, that's Stephen Chow. I'm sure that's either a translation error or just something that can't be translated, because it's clearly, if they reference them, then there must be something comedic going on there. But I had no idea what that was. But
did you say first, "Oh, it's Ng Man Tat," and then she's like, "No, it's not. It's Stephen Chow." So it was just very strange. And then she pointed at like her, and it was very strange. Yeah. I didn't understand that scene either. I think it might be something that the obviously subtitlers just thought, "Fuck this, just put a reference into some of the westerners will know about." Just they know who Stephen Chow is. Put Jackie Chan in there as well. Like, they'll get that. They'll know. They'll understand that. I felt it kind of. They didn't bother translating it because it was just probably a bit.
Maybe
too
it's
Japanese.
A laugh riot if you understand it, but I think that was one of the difficult ones. Over in a heartbeat, obviously. So it's not. It was not a joke that they made a core joke for the entire movie, obviously.
No.
But I'm essentially done, guys. So if you have any more highlights, mention that. But I wanted to throw out the question really to you guys, and mainly you, David, because you do follow Jeff Lau's work, current work as well. Do you feel that this energy, so to say, his comedic style, his skill at this time, is it at all similar in feel to what Jeff Lau does nowadays, or is it a different Jeff Lau even when he does well nowadays?
Well, his last few films, most of what he's done over the last decade, it's probably been kind of, with like a lot of filmmakers, it's kind of one eye at least on the sort of, Chinese market. So it's changed what he does and the way he does it to an extent, to try and sort of, get into that market and sort of, appeal to sort of, a different sort of sensibility. Mm-hmm. But, as I've mentioned on before, I think, his most recent film, East Meets West 2011, I think it's a real kind of return to form. It's not the same style as this film, but it's really on song, and the performances are great, and it actually, for me at least, that one sort of keeps going to the end. Mm-hmm. And and funnily enough, that as I think that film, in my opinion, that film really works. Its online kind of reviews on the mainland were terrible. Mm-hmm. People say, "Oh, this film, it stinks. It's one of the worst films ever made." Probably because it was more sort of, more sort of on the sort of Hong Kong wavelength. For local people, it's more attuned to their kind of sense of comedy and their sort of opinion of what makes a good comedy. Mm-hmm. So, but I think he's kind of. He's back on form, at least if the last film is anything to go by,
and not really desperately clinging on to his self from this time when legendary Le Rose Noir was made. Do you think it's developed is doing different things?
There's lots of the same, because East Meets West 2011, bears a lot of, at least sort of surface comparison with sort of Eagle Shooting Heroes. Mm-hmm. As it's in this big sort of group, big ensemble. But it's the same, it's similar but not the same.
Right.
It's you can kind of see other elements of his elements of his previous films in the last film, but the actual sort of it, you know, it looks different. You know, the sort of, you know, the performances are different. You know, the settings are different, but you know, some of the sort of some of the basics are the same. You know, the sort of you know, like the large groups and, you know, large groups of characters are sort of, you know, is sort of feel for comedy, but you know, the sort of, you know, specifics are different, but sort of basic things are sort of
right,
as you may have seen from other sort of Jeff Lau sort of films. But I think he's kind of you know, he's tried to sort of cultivate the sort of you know, the mainland market, but I think he didn't do that. He didn't really go for that on the last film particularly. It certainly didn't
maybe
get
one of the few sort of brave filmmakers in Hong Kong that essentially, you know, gives the middle finger to the mainland every now and again, you know, like Derek Yee did with Shinjuku Incident. You know, I'm not going to change anything, so I'm not even going to show it then in the mainland, so fuck you guys.
I love that. Yeah.
So
yeah.
All good fun. Any more highlights you want to mention, guys, from the movie?
I've got some stuff, but Dave, go first.
Okay, the first thing I ever remember hearing about the film was reading about it in an old Eastern Heroes publication back in the sort of early to mid-90s. Mm-hmm. It was, I think it was maybe a sort of a top 10 or a top 20 of sort of, you know, great films of the 90s or something like that, or films you may not have heard of and all this kind of stuff. And they said, oh, you know, it's this really sort of funny movie. And it was illustrated with a picture of Tony Leung-Kar-Fai from the film. The sequence that you mentioned earlier, Ken, where he's, you know, he's got the sellotape over his face. And it's just, you know, for that to be the first image that you see from the film, it was like, I thought, wow, well, yeah, what's this? You know, what's this movie? You know?
In.
Yeah, and you know, it didn't emerge on the sort of DVD for quite a while. And at the time that I first saw it, I didn't know much else other than, you know, sort of, you know, Stephen Chow and you know, a bit of Hoi Brothers. But you know, and I dug it at the time, you know, without getting, you know, not that I get all the references in there now, but you know, I get more sort of, you know, specific bits of it than I did first time round. But even then, I knew that was, you know, that it was, you know, it was for me. You know, I really sort of kind of enjoyed it. I just, you know, took it as it was. You know,
right.
Just without knowing a whole lot, it was just you know, it really sort of tickled me at the time. And so it sort of stayed with me, that one. It's, you know, I mean, there's a lot of sort of, you know, in references and kind of in jokes that are not, you know, every audience that watches it is going to get. Certainly not probably, you know, Western audiences. But, yeah, and for that reason, it's probably, you know, not the right film for, you know, a first stop on anyone's journey into sort of, you know, Chinese, you know, comedy sort of cinema. But
That's why I always held back watching this, because I thought like it's going to be a sort of a hit or miss experience, so it was never like a priority out of the Jeff Lau movies for me. I'm glad to I've gotten a chance to watch it for the show instead, to finally get it watched. But you know, I never got a sense if you liked movies like Haunted Cop Shop and Mortuary Blues, David, if you ever saw those from Jeff Lau.
Yeah, Haunted Cop Shop I've seen, yeah. That's just terrific, terrific fun as well.
And that flirted rather nicely with horror as well, which makes me, you know, yearn more for, you know, I still have Thunder Cops 2, which is a fantastic movie, you know, dark as hell, gloomy Jeff Lau, you know, Sandra stars in that, Queen of Comedy Sandra.
No.
It's just, really, Stephen Chow co-stars in it, not funny Stephen Chow, you know, it's, you know, borderlining a depressing movie, because
yeah, it's late 80s?
89, yeah, I think.
89. Yeah.
So, I mean, I think at some point I'm going to bring it up so you, we all three can watch that, because for the show, because it's a fantastic action movie, but man, is it gloomy, and fantastic for it, because it earns that as well. So, I would love to see Jeff Lau, you know, channel his, you know, dark side, so to say, even more. And maybe he will. You know, there's still life in him. It's not like he's seen to want to slow down. He wants to produce and generate contents still for Hong Kong or Hong Kong cinema or mainland cinema, so to say, depending on the movie.
Yeah, have you guys seen Savior of the Soul? It's from, I think, 91.
Oh, yeah. I didn't realize it was credited as a director on that one. I thought it was David Lai only, but I might be wrong.
He's listed to HKMDB as one of the directors on it. That's okay, right. Though. You might be co-director on that one. Directors Corey Yern, David Lai, and Jeff Lau.
Right.
So it might have been a three-way
situation.
Yeah, not impossible.
I mean, I don't remember if there's... obviously, the entire opening credits of Savior of the Soul is probably not translated, but I wouldn't be... be a shock or anything, because it's an energetic movie, good-looking movie, and combining David Lai, Corey Yoon, and Jeff Lau is not a bad thing. David Lai could shoot some very cool-looking movies. Corey Yoon, good action director.
Yep.
And Jeff Lau could bring the energy, so...
I remember enjoying that one. I only bring it up because I think that's the only one that's been released in the UK of Jeff Lau's film. It was on the Made in Hong Kong label.
Yeah, still got
it. On video,
I can see it. I can see it from here. It has a painted cover that looks kind of shit, but it's still fun.
Yeah,
it's a good film.
And they even get a Quentin quote on it. Actually... You know, acclaimed by Quentin, Reservoir Dogs, Tarantino. This is old stuff. You know, as the ultimate manga in most motion future fantasy extravaganza. So there you go. You know what? They do mention that it's co-directed by David Lai and Corey Yoon. So at least those two were sort of known to have been credited for the movie. And if you look at, if you read Chinese, maybe it will be very much revealed. The fact that Jeff Lau has a co-directing credit on that. So regardless, it's a kick-ass movie. Absolutely dig that.
Yeah.
It's funny looking at sort of UK releases for sort of, films that are heavy with, Cantonese comedy. It's very, very little. I mean, even with Stephen Chow, I mean, outside of kind of Shaolin Soccer and Kung Fu Hustle, there's a UK... DVD release for I think King of Beggars.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a couple.
It still works. It's a pretty action film movie. So.
And a couple of VHS Eastern Heroes VHS releases. I think $60 Million Man.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think so. I saw it advertised on Wondering Sleeves. Oh, I just thought of it. On Made in Hong Kong released two of his movies and. One of them is a head scratcher because it's a great movie. Fleur Tong Scholar, was released on Made in Hong Kong VHS, and remember that was mainly an action label. And I would have loved to see that because if they did a retranslation of it, and then if to see if they really worked on making some of the jokes come through. Because Fleur Tong Scholar, Fleur Tong, don't you dare?
Don't fuck it up.
It's a weird-ass, funny-ass movie, but, you know, I'm willing to bet 70% of the stuff in there just is incomprehensible for at least me, you know, and especially for anyone who doesn't know Cantonese. But
I think I remember I had the VHS of that. They weren't retranslated subs. I think it was just sort of, you know, the original kind of Buck burnt on...
You never knew really with Made in Hong Kong. Some were original cinema prints, some were retranslated.
I think they did Curry and Pepper as well. That's more, I mean, it's an action movie with comedy in it rather than
But the other Stephen Chow movie they did was God of Gamblers 3 back to Shanghai.
Yeah.
With him and Gong Li, which I think is was fairly straight. It was a time travel movie, but still it heavily references Ray Loy's character from The Bund. I think Ray Loy the TV series he did with Chow Yun-Fat. So they actually travel back to the Bund, essentially. it's a fun movie, but man, I would have loved to own those to see how they were done on VHS. I've seen them both physically, you know, but I never picked them up at the time because I didn't know of Stephen Chow. Definitely didn't know of Hong Kong comedy. When I bought Made in Hong Kong tapes, it was for the action. I was in my heroic bloodshed mode. You know, I wanted my curry and pepper, obviously. I got bullet in the head and all of that. But City on Fire, Fist of Legend, Prison on Fire. You know, it was those kind of classics.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, it's just that kind of old saying, is it that action always sells? It's, you know, it's universal language, whereas the comedy, it's not, you know, sadly, there's people who want it, but it's not going to, you know, sell.
It's definitely a harder sell.
Right on. So, any more mentions, or should we conclude it with
I've got a few more things, Ken.
Yeah, go on, mate.
Just a couple of mentions. Yeah, I like when they're cleaning the house, as we said. I also love the position they put the dead bodies in. It's almost like posed mannequins. As you say, I loved Theresa Mo in the film. I think she's an actress I'm really warming up to lately. I've seen recently in Magnificent Scoundrels. Really enjoy her comic presence. I think she's quite underrated. I think a lot of people. I think she's a bit like Marmite, isn't she? I think a lot of people kind of love her or hate her.
Yeah, she's definitely got her unique kind of style that's her own. You know, her sort of being a performance style is. You can't confuse it with anyone else. It's definitely her own thing. You know, but that sequence in the house where they go there sort of, you know, to kind of check it out, and they sort of stumble into the middle of the sort of the deal that's going down. That's got my favourite line in it. It doesn't necessarily sound that much out of context, but it's when they're kind of, stuff's going down and they're kind of, you know, hiding on the floor. They're making noises. And the guy turns around and goes, "Who's that?" And they go, "No one," and put their head down.
that scene you said though is great. I like it when he's pointing the gun towards him at the end, and she's like, "The rape her first." It's very darkly comic. But yeah, can any of you tell me why the small boy the two girls try to rob has the name of a Kevin Bacon musical drama on his flip flops?
Have you seen? I didn't see.
Did
that.
You notice that? Footloose. Yep, that was a bit of a strange one. Greatest subtitle ever, #S*... Said between the two black roses. I don't know whether you caught that one.
lazy subtitling.
I don't know what that meant.
I think it was if I remember the scene you're talking about, I think it was deliberate, the fact that they were saying some, it was actually foul language that wasn't ever meant to be subtitled. You know what I mean? Because it seemed like they were even mumbling, it seemed like. So I'm willing to bet there was sort of a deliberate. And if they translated it, maybe it would have been category 3 automatically, because you never know.
Another great one, upon inspection of the two dummies that they're dressed in the mask, we have the statement, "What, they're puppies?"
I remember that.
A classic, you know, subtitle error. And even though I missed her during the second half, I like after all that happens at the house, after we cut back to Theresa Murphy, she's still in prison with a piece of wood in her hand about half an hour later in the film, still waiting to get out. And a tiny little one, there's a man with a golden gun sound cue when between a bomb step the brawl, which I thought was interesting. Just a tiny little snippet. And that's all my notes.
Right on.
Yep.
We're doing Vampire Season next week. But having said that, next pick for a sort of joint movie discussion will be yours, Tom. So have you actually pondered what will be your pick in the show that comes out in 2 weeks' time?
I do. Yeah. It's more for you, Ken, than... Do you want me to reveal right now?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's more for you, Ken, than I think David. I don't know how David feels. It's a Benny Chan film. And that film is Shaolin from last year.
Okay. I haven't seen it, so maybe Benny Chan, you have a chance to redeem yourself after my slaughter of New Police Story. way back in the day, a half an hour rant. Angry Ken, one of the few instances of Angry Ken.
So, yep, that'll be, shit if you're on that. As you say, Ken, couple of time.
Yes. Yeah, don't. I almost got myself started on your police story again. You know, love and puppies and clouds and everything is fun. Yes, I'm back now. Alrighty, looking forward to that in 2 weeks' time. And next week, as I said, vampire season and three movies, including one in the bonus episode section. So we are done, but some quick contact information again. You've been listening to Podcast on Fire at the Podcast on Fire Network, the Anchor Show. And it is located at podcastonfire.com. Our various means of being contacted. Email, podcastonfire@googlemail.com. You can hit us up on our message forum, podcastonfire.com/forum. Listen in on the extensive members-only archive. And listen in on the bonus episodes that we've started fairly recently. That is on the website. On Facebook, we have our fan page, facebook.com/POF Network. And if you search Podcast on Fire Network in the search box, you'll also find our discussion group. So you're very much welcome in to have a chat with all of us. We're on Twitter as well, twitter.com/podcastonfire. I do my writing at sogoodreviews.com and sleazykvideo.com. Coming up tomorrow is official Exterminator Kill for Love, more IFD for you all. And I'm also on Twitter, twitter.com/sogoodreviews. Listen to and subscribe to Podcast on Fire Network on iTunes. And you can also stream Podcast on Fire Network on Stitcher, either download it to your computer or your smartphone. And what is there to say briefly about Hong Kong Gig Guide, David?
I've got the first show through for April, so I'm getting closer and closer to, you know, getting details of shows that I'll actually be able to go to. So that'll be fun.
Right on.
Yeah.
Do you think you want to do some podcasting from Hong Kong, or that's?
Yeah, it could do if we could figure out the time differences and all that.
Yeah. Dopey podcast way down on the list. Always remember that. right on, Tom. TheCinemaShow.com, your reviews coming out at a steady pace of one per every three, four weeks or months.
We're trying for monthly. We'll see what happens. But yeah, just keep your eyes peeled for my contribution to Korean Blog Thumb, which should be very, very soon.
Right. And that's next week for everybody who wants to participate in the Korean Blogathon 2012, hosted by New Korean Cinemas in Awesome and some other sites as well who are going to mirror the link. So if any of the sites actually goes offline due to heavy traffic like last year for New Korean Cinema, there's always going to be it's always going to be a link archive available. I don't know exactly how it works, but they learned from last year that the demand and the traffic is actually quite high. Which is great. So they prepared well, and we as you said, will be having our What's Korean Cinema podcast linked as part of the blogathon as well. But anyway, this has been Podcast on Fire 114, and I've been your host Kenneth Wilson, and with me was Hong Kong Dave.
Hi.
And Tom KW.
See ya.
We're channeling Undefeatable again.
Undefeatable.
See ya. You have the right to remain silent, so shut up.
Get it on again.
Yeah.